we all need time of quiet solitude with ourselves. And given that, children's development is much, much better.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
My name is Joseph Chilton Pierce, and I live in Central Virginia. I've written 7 books.
Can we talk about the importance of play in children's lives, but also the importance of real work, as opposed to kind of work that someone prescribes for them?
Our great neuroscientist, Paul MacLean, who was 40-some years head of brain development research there at the National Institutes of Health, came up with 3 needs. He calls them the kind of a triune or trinity of needs that children have right from the moment of birth on. And those are audio-visual communication, nurturing, and play. And they're equally important, and they're all interdependent. Each depends on the other. And it's interesting that play would be included as the most important possible things that a child can have, not only for the development of their body, but of their whole neural system and so on. And play begins almost immediately at birth. It really does. Very quickly it begins. A child catches on very quickly when an adult is willing to play with them. And play can take place only in what Michael Mendez and I call the safe space that a child must feel secure in order to play. And, of course, that's what the true audiovisual communication and nurturing provide, is a safe space. And given that safe space, the spontaneous reaction is to play and to turn every activity into play. Children, I don't think, have much connection with work. They will turn the work into play, or they will play at the work, which is exactly what they should do. In Montessori schools, they use the term work, but if you look closely, you'll see that there's the same spontaneous freedom of movement, speech, and play that you have, let's say, in a Waldorf school. And it's a critical part of all learning, is that ability to approach it playfully. And the reason has to do, literally, it sounds like we're trying to make a mountain out of a molehill, but it has to do with the structure of the brain itself. When they're in a totally safe space, feel completely secure, loved, protected, nurtured, the center of action shifts into what we call the forebrain, which is the latest evolutionary brain structure. The one of creative imagination, the one that will lead us to metaphoric, symbolic thinking, which underlies all of our great subjects like science and mathematics and philosophies and religions and so on. All of those depend on metaphoric, symbolic capacities, which are developed literally in play. And play is the only way that this metaphoric, symbolic capacity can develop. Play can only take place in a safe space, because if the child feels at all insecure, a good part of their energy of their brain and body registers or centers around the defensive modes of mind, which are the ancient sensory motor, what we call the hindbrain or reptilian brain, the oldest parts of the brain system. And in fact, you can, by the new scanning devices and all, you can clearly see when the child is shifting from the forebrain, which is called the high civilized mind, the human, truly human brain, back into the more ancient animal structures out of defense when they're concerned about their safety and all. Play is the really, George, about the only way we have in the first 7 years of really developing this great creative forebrain that sets us light years above all of the animals on Earth. The most important form of play arises probably from storytelling after about the first year of life. Up until then, it's any repeated action, interaction between the infant and the parent, hiding, peekaboo, things like that, the little surprise movements, and repeated over and over, the child immediately interprets this as play, and they go into a state of just hilarious delight over it. They'll do this from very early on, but after about age one, when they really have their speech and language pretty well under control, storytelling is a primary impetus to play, because having been told a story, they literally create internal imagery in keeping with the nature of the story. And that activity in itself brings about neural development. And then they want to play that inner image out in the world. That's when you'll get your symbolic and metaphoric play begins. That's when finally the little boy will pick up a spool of thread and it will become an automobile. The little girl will find a matchbox and becomes a little chest of drawers or a bed or for a little miniature doll or something like that, where one object can stand for another, and that's metaphoric play. And it's the basis of all metaphoric thinking for the rest of our life. It literally gives the neural foundations for metaphor and symbol. And when they begin to see that a little twist of cloth around a clothespin gives them a doll to play with, seeing one object and another, they're laying the foundations for being able to look at numbers and alphabets and things like that and see what they stand for, what they mean, what the inner meaning of them is. That's transferring information from one object to another. So you find that imagination is the key to all higher human intelligence, and imagination is developed only in play. They have really never found a culture that doesn't have a whole repertoire of stories to tell the early child, the child in the first 7 years. They all are surprisingly similar, the culture stories, and they're all designed, literally, to develop this capacity of metaphoric, symbolic thinking. Generally, children's models are of the next level of age. The five-year-old will be fascinated with following the seven-year-old around. They want to see how they should behave as what they think of as a grown person there, and so on. So we have that model aspect of imitative play. I think a profound error is made in thinking that the early child, that is in about the first 7 years, must be given a great deal of social interaction. Social interaction really unfolds with the huge shift that takes place in development around 6 to 7. And then they're going to need and look for some kind of social interaction. But in that period, say from about 7 up to about 11, when you have another big shift in the whole neural structure, one dear close friend is all it takes. And children will have very passionate close friends at that point, but they don't need a whole bunch of children. And certainly the early child doesn't. If you put two early children, let's say 2, 4, 5-year-olds together in a room, they'll look like they're playing, but they're simply sharing the same stage. They're each playing out their entirely private little worlds. They don't need a lot of social interaction. They do need interaction with adults and some older children, but not a great deal of it. We make this error of thinking we've got to fill the child's for early years up with all sorts of busy social interaction, and it's just not the case. We do well to remember Burton White, one of Harvard's greatest developmentalists years ago, about 50 years ago, in 1973 or 4, I think, he published a book on the first 3 years of life, and he spoke of the critical need in the early years of giving the child vast periods all to themselves. He said that they had done a study of children in literate societies like ours. The brilliant, happy children, he found about 3% of the children who could be considered really brilliant and happy had spent an inordinate amount of time in their early childhood in blank, open-eyed staring, doing nothing at all. And if you look in their eyes in those periods of blank, open-eyed staring, there's no one at home.
Yes.
That drives us parents up a wall. We'll do something. But this is a critical part of the balance of their whole inner life with their outer world. You know, when Piaget spoke of the child of the dream, that child from 3 or 4 on up to about 7, a beautiful term, really, the child of the dream. Their one foot is in the dreamlike world of the preconceptual, and the other is in the physical world. And they've got to be allowed to spend lots of time in both. Rudolf Steiner, of course, spoke of the child in the etheric world at that period. They only have one foot in the physical. The other foot is in the etherical world. And if you jar them out of that and make them attend with everything to the physical world too soon, you'll have a very imbalanced and disturbed child.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Yesterday, a child came out to wander, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful, when the sky was full of the seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go. Child moved 10 times round the seasons, skated over 10 clear frozen streams. Words like, when you're older, must appease him, and promises of someday make his dream. The seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came and go. Springs and 16 summers gone now. Cartwheels turn to car wheels through the town, and they tell him, take your time, it won't be long now. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can't return, we can only look behind from where we came. Better dreams and plenty before the last revolving year is through. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel of time. We can only look behind from where we came and go round and round and round in the circle game. And go round and round and round in the circle game.
We all need time of quiet solitude with ourselves, and given that, children's development is much, much better. And then when they need interaction with other children, they'll make that clear. You know, you have to honor where the child is at these stages of development. Certainly the business of slapping them in a desk at school and demanding high-level abstract thinking from them is a tragedy at that stage. That doesn't mean that some children don't spontaneously read just from being read stories to. I had two of my children in my first family that were spontaneously reading by the time they were four. Why? Because their mother had read to them from the moment they were born on. And they wanted to keep those magical words going, to keep that magical inner world going. The great Hans G. Furth, the Austrian child psychologist, said that's the primary reason for spontaneous reading in children, is to keep that inner world going by those magical words being furnished around which the inner response of imagery forms. But the idea of teaching them to read and write at that age doesn't really work. And by the way, Maria Montessori was horrified when people used the term teaching her 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. She said, we don't teach them at all. She said, we give them a loving, nurturing environment, and the absorbent mind absorbs what it wants to and what is suitable to it. People were beginning to take what they called her techniques for teaching reading and writing and apply them in our school system, and of course you don't get the same results at all. Taking your cues from your child is a critically important thing here. If we're thinking more, what needs of that is that child expressing and picking up from them the cues that they're calling for and following through on them, learning will take place very quickly. But if we're looking at the child with the idea of imprinting them with our notions of what they should be doing at that point, we're then looking at them through a grid of what we think our cultural needs are rather than the signals being sent to the child. But if you take your cues from the child, they'll nearly always indicate to you their areas of interest, their areas they're open to and ready to absorb. Let me ask you, have you heard of David Albert's book about homeschooling?
Yes, I've read that one.
It's yes.
Skylark
Sings with...
Yes. Yes, I read that one.
In fact, he's on the lecture circuit now, going all around the country promoting homeschooling. Mm. That's a remarkable work. because he points out that it was his real education here. I think he had a PhD when he started in, but he said his learning from trying to stay one jump ahead of that child was the most exciting and exhilarating and difficult job that he had ever undertaken. Because they're moving at lightning speed when they're getting their cues met. I think Jean Liedlauf's book, The Continuum Concept, is the greatest model we'll ever find. And she speaks of how these little children, the Yucana in South America, want to take part in every social activity practically from birth on. They just want to take part in it to get a rough idea of the activity. And the parents always let them, if mama's stirring something the child wants to stir, they'll let them stir. They're not going to keep it up very long. They want to rough in the pattern of that kind of activity. And so they want to stick their finger in everything going on, but they don't necessarily have to be kept at the task in that early period. You let them follow their own interest and inclination. And as they grow older, they're going to want to complete tasks to please their parents, to please their society, and take part in that society. And she said that in among the Yucana, they will say to a child, you know, get some firewood for a fire. And the child always does. People had no word for disobedience or failure to obey. They had no word for obey. They assumed that the child wanted to take part in any adult activity that they were capable of, and they always did. On the other hand, we all have people assigning their children to do work, and then there's this great nagging fuss about you must complete your task. Now, that comes much later. From my way of looking at a very important item about children on up in the social age, 8 or 9 or 10, to earn some money is a thrilling thing for them. And I used to, you know, we would shovel someone's sidewalk as best we could and get a nickel for it, and we were thrilled. And so on, any kind of activity that we could do and get paid for it, particularly from a neighbor, not from my own parents, that was work, and we loved it. And later, when you hit your teens very, very much need meaningful employment to some extent. And to have a newspaper route or a drugstore job after school is not bad at all, because they need that. It gives them a feeling of competence, of security, that they can take their place in the world. They can earn money also, if that's what it is. The age that the child is in determines the nature and character of the work that they're involved with.
I have my 3 girls, 5, 6, and 8, and I try to get them each to take a turn doing the dishes. But I will say, okay, it's your turn today, and there might be some fussing. And
the way I solved that problem, because I had 4 of them I was bringing them back, so their mother died. And the way I solved that problem was really to turn it into play. And you find that if they're drying the dishes, they'll start flipping each other with the towel and so on and so forth. That's all part of it. They'll convert it into play, but they'll get the job done eventually. You have to have a lot of patience and tolerance with them and not turn it into painful labor that they're going to be censored for if they don't do a certain way and so on. You have to treat it as a joint venture of kind of playful working at something. I really do think that's important, keeping their room straight, cleaning up their messes and so on. I think there are mediated learning, like Reuven Feuerstein talked about over in Israel, doing it with them, a model for how to do it right with them, and then just kind of easing your hands off and letting them take over is another thing can always be done. And if it's approached, I think the word work there again is kind of dangerous. Children tend to live out our intentions. And if our underlying intentions is they must learn to do this in order to mind, behave, and be responsible. They're going to sense that, and that's not play, and they'll resent it. They'll object to it, and they'll drag their feet and balk. So if your underlying intent yourself is to enjoy this as a literally sounds corny, but as a joyful venture of the family and all, they will tend to pick up your intention and live it out. Jean Liebloff makes that clear in her marvelous book, The Continuum Concept. The underlying intention with which we approach our children will be picked up and lived out by the child. In that regard, let me throw one more thing in, and that is our teenagers. We have, as a nation here in the United States, for a long time regarded our teenagers as trouble. A bad, bulky, troublesome age. And the underlying intent of our response to them is potential trouble. And they will tend to act out our underlying intent without even being aware of what they're doing. And that really is true. It's one of those strange, what we call looped effects between parent and child, or society and child. If our underlying intent is to maintain that interaction of play with them, a lot can be done. I don't think the concept of minding, that they must learn to mind, should ever enter in. I don't think they must learn to mind. Minding is generally cultural conformity. We're insisting that they conform to a culture's behavior pattern, lest we as parents be censored for it, for their failure. And so they pick up that intent from us, that our basic feeling is fear that they, the parent, will be censored if the child doesn't behave in a certain way. And there's no love and nurturing and play in that kind of an activity. One quick thing about models. Greenfield and Tronick, part of Jerome Bruner's great team of child psychologists at Harvard University years ago, came up with something that we've since begun to overlook. They called it the cycle of competence, which underlies all learning. The cycle of competence was that, first of all, the child must have a rough overall idea of what a new learning or activity it is. They must rough in this basic framework or concept of a new activity. And then the brain itself, I mean, their whole mind and everything will be cued toward filling that empty category in with material. And so they will attend to all the parts and bits of information that might help with this roughed-in idea of a particularly new activity that they have seen from a model, getting their rough idea of it. And then once they fill that in with their content through their own exploration and everything, they'll want to practice the completed pattern over and over and over ad nauseum. And from that comes what we call the ability to transfer. There's a term in mathematics, I forgot what it is, when you can transfer that particular kind of activity over to other roughly similar activities. And that will be the third and final stage of learning. But that first stage of learning, in which we need to rough in an overall idea, a basic category, frame of reference for the learning, and that comes about through models. The idea of modeling for your child. Children can't become who we tell them to become. They become who we are. And so it behooves us to be what we want our child to become. And that means we must be the model we want for them. This has to do with resonance. The way the brain seems to work, I think of Paul McLean's talk recently about the way that brain works is through resonance. It has to be given a resonant source of that finished product to initiate its own learning process. The tragedy of our schools is that the child's mind brain will not learn incrementally. We think that in school, each day we can give them another little bit of information about this subject, say mathematics and so on, add it all up together, and at the end of the year, they'll have this subject under their hats called mathematics. The brain doesn't work that way. Even in mathematics, something so abstract as that, they must be given an overall idea of each one of those processes to rough it in, and then giving them the incremental pieces has a ready pattern, what we call a neural field in the brain, ready to receive that kind of information, and learning takes place. Rudolf Steiner understood this particularly well in Waldorf schools. By the way, Waldorf school, their curricula is really applicable at home. You can really apply it at home awfully well. And they're beginning to adapt Waldorf programs for homeschooling. The idea of being the best possible model you can for your child is, of course, critically important. Just critically important. The child will become who we are, not who we tell them to be, and that really ought to scare the bejabbers out of us. But it's just the truth. You can't act one way and then think you can turn around and berate the child verbally and have them behave in a different way. None of us became who our parents demanded and expected us to be. We became some variation of our parents. But it's also a tremendous opportunity because each of us can break the vicious cycle that's been handed down for ages with our own children. Of course, the parentist model is critically important, but they're going to hit that world out there. They're going to hit the world of culture and have to make adaptations to it as well. But I wouldn't worry about that. I've heard people who will not send their children to Waldorf school because the child is happy in Waldorf or Montessori, and they'll say, look, it's a jungle out there. We've got to toughen our children up and ready to meet that jungle out there. And I say that's the equivalent of saying that it's a mad world out there and you must drive your child mad in order to live in it. I said the strongest, greatest thing you can do for your child to deal with the mad world is to be absolutely whole and sane. And they do that largely through our modeling for them.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.